Kivanu la'asok b'divrei Torah. So, one of the balances we have in religion, or in Judaism, is between understanding that there are things that are real that are invisible, but not pretending that we know them so well that we're on like a first name basis with them, and that we're so familiar with them that we want to manipulate them, or we create worlds of what is invisible that we then turn into idols. And that's what religion is really all about. It's why I think that religion in its essence, when it's done correctly, is walking this tightrope of saying that the world is not everything that the world is not just made up of atoms and tables and chairs and objects. The idea that the world's not more than what we see is the key part of what religion is about in general. How do you live in a world in which you don't have all the information you need about what we're living in? And this is one of the reasons that I think science and religion are basically doing very much the same things. I mean, people take science to say, well, science is saying, no, the only thing that really exists is the natural world. But that's a pretty old-fashioned view of science. Because really, what was, you know, healing based on the fact that there are things like germs that you can't see that are real. And we want to understand the laws of how those work. And so we can understand them. And then maybe you make tools that see things you didn't see before. Most of science today is physics. And it's almost all theoretical. It's all about math. Math is not something you see. So for me, it's like people think of science as being about, well, it's not about the supernatural. It's about the natural, like Galileo. And they're just talking about the planets moving around the Earth, or the Earth moving around the Sun, or they're just talking about objects fall down and things that are solid. But really, no. Science from a very early time was already saying, wait a second, there's this mathematical reality around us. And there's gravity itself. Gravity was basically saying that there's an invisible force that operates that you can't see. And that was centuries ago, and gravity was basically, we still basically believe in gravity. Gravity is the weirdest thing in the world. It's basically just saying that if I had to come up with a hypothetical example of an invisible thing that is real, it is that if I put two objects, there is actually an invisible force that pulls them together. That's all gravity is, the idea that there's an invisible force, that everything, every time you have something, it's making it want to move toward each other. Like, that's even like more weird than magnetism.
It's mathematically saying that space and time are warped.
Right, and then Einstein changes that to say, well, you know, yeah, go ahead.
Can I have your keys and Spencer can put those books in your car?
Sure.
Okay.
Thank you.
So, could you take one and pass these to the
person? Oh, I found my watch.
Yeah. It was in my pocket. I couldn't find it. Okay, good, because I was about to tell you I couldn't find it.
Right, and then Einstein and others said, you know, well, there is still kind of an invisible force, but it's much more complicated than that. There's something like curvature of space-time. The space and time are part of a larger reality, and so these are kind of like they're both on a slide. When you put them near each other, you curve space-time, so they're sliding into each other. They're shifting. But all of that is based on the fact that we live in an invisible reality. You're like, wait a second. I live in a place where, like, I'm in curved space-time? Like, that's absurd. But science was always moving in that direction. So the way most people think of science, to me, is entirely wrong. They think of it in what philosophy calls naturalism, that the only thing that is real is that which is natural. At one point, I was going to do my dissertation on the issues of naturalism and Is religion about, because I was in the philosophy of religion, I was choosing a topic. Do I want to choose on, and my base area was science and religion, so do I want to look at, is religion really about supernaturalism? And I went to one of the smartest philosophers in the world, and I said, it was maybe going to be on my committee, and I said, look, I'm thinking of this as my topic. And he said, you don't want to do that topic. Is religion really about things that are supernatural? And I said, why not? He said, because. It was a brilliant thing he said, and of course he was right, and I followed up on it. The whole idea of what's called naturalism, the theory that all there is the natural, our natural phenomena, the natural universe, is a completely incoherent, untenable theory. In other words, you want to say, well, you have this idea that all that's real is like science and physical things and natural things and the scientific forces of the universe. And he's like, But the problem is that even though people walk around, like the atheists of the world walk around with the idea, I don't believe in anything supernatural, I only believe in the natural, there is no such thing as the natural. That's basically the idea. He's like, the problem is you'll start writing the dissertation. If you want to write a dissertation, you can write a dissertation on the incoherence of the theory that there is such a thing as the natural. Like that you can make that distinction between natural and supernatural even hold. And so, but he's like, the problem is that's been written, and by very great philosophers, not even new. I mean, they knew that hundreds of years ago. And I started realizing that many philosophers knew that. So the problem is the atheism that is the fastest growing religion in America today is often based on an idea that most philosophers would laugh at, which is that, well, all there is the natural world. What do you mean? All there is space-time? Well, now it's superstrings. Superstrings are entirely theoretical. 10 dimensions of the universe, what does that even mean? Is that natural that we live in 10 dimensions, 11 dimensions? What if that changes? Well, what it means is that we live in a world of cause and effect. Well, then how do you handle fractal theory? The fact that there actually is true chaos theory, that there is chaos within that. So it's like you start to realize that all the areas you want to go with where you want to define, no, there's nothing outside of the natural world. What natural world are you talking about? The world of cause and effect? How about the world of chaos? Well, no, okay, that too. How about like fractal development? How about multiple dimensions, right? And so you quickly get to a point where most people who are atheists don't even want to, they want to criticize religion, but they don't understand that religion is not just a simple opposite of that, which is don't trust the natural world. There's another world you live in, the supernatural world. Right, the angels and supernatural involvement. But religion's even not necessarily or shouldn't be adopting a simple distinction, unless you're Ted Cruz or somebody. But otherwise, religion, when it's at its best, it's walking this bridge between that the world we live in is a real world. The physical world is real, and whatever. But that the world is a more complicated, how do we live in the shadow of dimensions and universes that we don't fully understand? How do we have the humility to walk in that world? And if someone says, and this is my criticism of Revelation, as you know, there are religious people who adopt the natural supernatural distinction wholeheartedly, and they end up in these crazy places, which is they're as bad as the atheists. They end up in the fact that many things I've already talked about, but just one briefly. Well, the Torah can only be true if God spoke in a voice out of the sky. What they're doing is they're making something physical and natural. They're saying, well, it was a supernatural voice. I'm like, what's a supernatural voice? It sounds like this. Moses, get out your pen. But then what you want to say philosophically is, that's a natural voice. In other words, that's an actual voice. That could have been made by an alien or something. You know what I mean? That could have been made by anyone. That could have been made by someone playing a practical joke on Moses. Right? And then it's like, oh, but it wasn't. We have witnesses. You're still dealing with like this is an actual physical observation of a natural phenomenon called God's voice, right? And it's a voice like any other voice. And then as I've told you before, but you look at the revelation of Mount Sinai we just did last week on Shabbat, and it says God didn't speak in a voice. It said God spoke in kolot, in sounds, and thunders, and it says the God spoke in shofar blasts. What? Like, the Torah is going out of its way to say this was not a natural phenomenon, but don't turn it into a supernatural phenomenon that's like, oh, no, I know. It was like shofars. It sounded like shofars. Well, they also said sound like thunder. What the Torah is trying to do is say, let the divine be the divine. In the book of Genesis, did God make the world in 6 days? The rabbis say, a God day and a human day are not the same thing. Let a God day be a God day, and we don't know how long a God day is. Did God speak with a human voice or a natural voice on Mount Sinai? And the rabbis are saying, let God's voice just be God's voice. In other words, let it be a holy mystery. In this way, I'm a little bit Catholic. You know, it's like, let mysteries be mysteries. As soon as you stop letting the mysteries be mysteries, then you've adopted, there's a supernatural, but it looks just like a natural, except it's supernatural. You know what I mean? So it's like healing. You know, like let healing be all of the things put together. The healing with your body, the spontaneous shifts of your immunological system. Let it be a mixture of a mysterious process and a not mysterious process. But don't believe, like, no, you get God antibodies that are inserted into you like God's voice through the clouds or something. Like, you're just making supernatural be just more natural, but you put the word God on it, and you sound ridiculous, you know? And so, like, you know, I don't believe that you, I mean, I could be wrong. For me, when you pray for someone to be healed, you are praying with the humility that you're not exactly entirely sure what the power of your prayer can be. But if you really think that you want to get a scientist in here to do a study, that if you get 30 people to pray for my planner's work to go away, it shrank a little bit, like, I think you're wasting your time. You know what I mean? Like, I just think that, like, because you've just turned, you know, the religious, spiritual, open-ended, humble process of praying for healing into, if 30 people do it, we can measure an effect. You've just turned it into another natural phenomenon. You've taken the divine out of it. You've taken the holy out of it. I'm much more interested in leaving it as, let a God healing be a God healing. Do sometimes people go into remission? Yeah. Do we exactly know how that happens? Not yet. Sometimes we know. Is it because someone prayed? Maybe. Maybe not. Could it be that a bunch of people prayed, and by praying they reminded themselves to go visit that person and check in with that person and call that person? And is it possible that shifting that person's morale somehow shifted the way their body fights diseases? Yeah. It's possible. But, like, let it be mysterious. Just like let it be something. You have to be able to devote your life to this line between the mysterious and the physical, but not just turn one into another. But the reason I was originally mentioning that was, like, you know, I was talking to someone about, well, we have some pregnant folks here, thank God, and about the idea that it's very easy to lapse into the supernatural, right? It's very easy to say that the reason the Holocaust happened is that the mezuzah scrolls inside Jews' mezuzahs in Germany and Poland, they used old scrolls. And so the evil spirits were not warded off, and therefore the Nazis could come in and kill them. That's a lot of people believe this stuff, folks. And it's very insulting, and it goes to this idea that I know what this invisible world is. And I know how to manipulate it. It's witchcraft and it's witch magic, because you're basically saying it's that these invisible forces of the that I live in, I know what they are. They're really no different than X, Y, and Z. And so you oversimplify it. And so that was part of the place I was going with how we walk the line between believing in the invisible but not thinking that we understand it and can control it and we know exactly what that looks like, because then we just lapse into the opposite of faith. The opposite of faith. So let's head right into the text where it says, we're on 236 and 237. We're at the end of Tamar has just fooled Judah into sleeping with her as a prostitute.
Wait.
Am I wrong, 236 and 237?
No, you're right.
Good, thanks.
Yeah.
Wait.
Can you get some air in here? Okay, Alex, that does open. Can you just slide it open? It's a slider. Go ahead.
Nothing to realize before we start.
Yeah.
But wasn't there also the Tamar with Noah? Same name? Am I getting this mixed up?
Was there a Tamar with Noah?
I thought it was the same thing that she said with her.
Oh. Do you mean this kind of stuff going on? I don't remember a Tamar.
It
with
wasn't
Noah.
Then.
There was a Timra or something. I don't remember a Tamar with Noah. We can look back. I mean, it would be Genesis, like, chapters 6. Chapter 10, here we go. Noah came out of the ark. He got drunk. The unspeakable happened. And these are the defendants, okay. The descendants.
Okay.
I don't see it. It would be on 54 and 55.
Okay.
You may know something I don't, but
no,
we'll keep it in mind.
There
are an awful lot of names there. Okay. So she sleeps with him. We did at the end that she gives him a chance to publicly repudiate her, because even though she has the staff and the cord as the pledge, so it's on 236.
Mm-hmm. On 237 is where she
okay, good. But I'll just do that one where she said, "You must leave a pledge until you have sent the goat that you promised me for sleeping with me." He said, "What pledge?" She said, "Leave your seal and your cord and your staff. These are key signs for the fact of the future, which is that the seal and the cord and the staff represent the messiahship and the kingship. So who eventually becomes her descendant is King David. So he becomes the king of Israel. So that's the seal, the king's seal, who becomes the staff, I believe, is messiahship, and that would be eventually the Messiah has to come from the Davidic line, so the Messiah will be a descendant of this union of her, of Tamar's, even though she's not an Israelite, she's not a Hebrew, and as I said before, this becomes repeated again with the fact that Ruth also becomes the maternal ancestor of King David and of the Messiah, and Ruth is a Moabite, and the Moabites are forbidden to intermarry with the Hebrews. So the Bible and the Talmud have a way of having set Jewish laws that also become undermined, and there's a subversive element to the fact that sometimes the rules don't apply, and so we have to. It itself is warning us about being overly legalistic, in a sense. So that you may say, well, we had this terrible experience, and for whatever you do, don't ever associate with an Arab. And then it'll be like, and the next day, an Arab just saved Jerusalem, right? Which used to happen a lot. When Jerusalem was attacked in the Six-Day War, it was the Arabs who are now being displaced and their homes taken away from them and then being kicked out of East Jerusalem were the ones that actually stood up against other Arabs to protect their Jewish neighbors. And so, like, you have these things where you're like, ah, I hate them. Yeah, they saved us. I don't know what to do with that. So we have this with Messiah. Often it's the non-Jews in the Torah who have a relationship with God and end up doing the right thing. And we've seen that over and over again in the book of Genesis. And you see it later even in the book of Jonah and things like that. So then later on it says... After 3 months later, Judah was told, "Your daughter-in-law Tamar has played the harlot. In fact, she's pregnant, and she has never slept with the son Shelah." And says, "Bring her out, let her be burned." As she was brought out, she sent a message to her father-in-law, "I'm with child by the man to whom the seal and cord and staff belong." She gives him a chance to take them back and silence her and burn her anyway. And so the rabbis basically say, as we did last time, that this really proves that she's noble. I mean, that she is shaming him, and she's doing everything right. She's giving him a chance to save face, and she's giving him the complete choice, Judah, whether to do the right thing or to cover up his deed. And so then he recognized them, and she says, "She's more in the right than I, in as much as I didn't give her to my son Shelah." And he was not intimate with her again. And she gave birth to twins, and so on. They came out, and we're on chapter 39, the next page. So, quick question. We did it at the end for the four or five people we did, but we'll open up to everyone, which is, let's not oversimplify the story to just one thing, but if we had to oversimplify the story to just one thing, why does the story come here to interrupt the book, the story, the saga of Joseph's travails? Because we just completely interrupt the Joseph story, and then chapter 39 is, and then when Joseph was taken down to Egypt, it's not like, and many years later, Joseph was in Egypt. It is completely interrupted the story. So what is the point to insert the story here and interrupt the flow? So what would be the point? And someone who wasn't here last time, who wasn't here at the end last time when we did it out loud. I mean, it's a complicated story with all kinds of things, but why would this story of Tamar and Judah come in at this point, particularly about Judah? What is the story accomplishing? Okay, so if it is about Judah's karma, then what's going on? Let's just say it's about Judah's karma, about him paying a price for something he did. What did Judah do?
He told on
Right.
Told on Jesus, right?
Well, no, that's Judas.
Judas.
You're the wrong class.
Sorry.
No, no, I'm sorry. No, no. Gloria, we did talk about that last time.
Okay.
Right. So Judah, not Judas, yes. But Judas is a character who is, I personally am not sure even Judas was real, but Judas is a character that means Judah, in the New Testament, who's playing a part in the New Testament, I think, in the story to discredit Judaism.
Right.
Okay. But Judah here, how does Judah discredit himself? What did Judas do? What's his big action? We read it. What's the main thing Judas did? Judah did so far. Now you got me doing it.
Yeah.
What did Judah do? Did Judah save or hurt Joseph? In between. So what the other brothers, apparently, besides Reuben and Judah, wanted to kill Joseph. And Reuben said, yeah, let's throw him into the pit, thinking he would come back later and save him. But Judah didn't know that, by the way. Reuben didn't tell Judah that. So Judah's the one that he's the one that comes out looking the best of the worst by saying, let's sell him. Sells him. And in the New Testament, the character of Judas, who represents the Jews, his name is Jew. So Jesus' friend Jew sells him to the Romans, betrays him to the Romans for the pieces of silver, right? But we are named after Judah. So his name is Jew because we're named after him. And Washington State is named after George Washington, I hope. I probably isn't. I probably have that wrong. But now, is that so great that he sold his brother? He's the one that we're named after. He's the best of the tribes. And he's the one that sold his brother into slavery. So you could argue, how could you defend him? How could you argue? Let's do an easy question. How did Judah do a good thing here by selling Joseph into slavery? Saved his life. Thanks, Becky. He saved his life. Okay, that's better than, other kinds of things.
But the preamble would be Tamar's story.
Good.
You're showing a good side of him. He actually, when he could have had her stoned, burned, put to death, but he said, no, I'm going to own up to the fact that those are my own things. So that he redeems himself a little bit there.
Good. He does. And now if you're talking about karma, yeah, go ahead.
He also admitted he was wrong.
He admitted he was wrong. Good. Now, we have a whole saga coming up of who's wrong, who's admitting they're wrong, how do you get to go through the process of wrong. But you also have a process of karma going on, which is that, in Hebrew it's a very traditional, when you are interpreting Torah, always look for cases of midah keneged midah. In Hebrew, measure for measure, but it means that you did something bad, and now you pay a price, and you clear your account. I think that sounds like karma to me. I studied a lot of Eastern stuff. The idea that you want to clear your account. We don't want to get too off base on this. It doesn't mean that if you get some debilitating disease, you're like, oh, thank you, I'm paying the price for all my sins. And the Talmud discusses this in Masechet Brachot. And they ask, look, you don't want to go too far with this. But the bottom line is, in other ways, you can grow through accepting that, in a way, maybe you're a sinner too, because we have a tendency to all point the finger at everyone else, right? Everyone else has anger. I don't. Everyone else refuses to play with their kids and just stays on their cell phone. I don't. And we have a tendency not to see the fact that I totally took my kids to the park the other day and played on my cell phone, and they wanted to play with me. We have a way of saying, I never cut people off on traffic. They just do it to me, right? I never take a parking spot that someone else had an eye on. They just do it to me. You know what I mean? But we do. And, I'm the best husband in the world, not. So
I'm the best mom.
And Misha said he didn't agree with that. No, but he...
he confirms it every day.
So that the idea is that could we go through life where, when something happens, we actually say maybe, I'm almost a little glad I got cut off in traffic today because I do that. We see that a sin in another is also a sin in ourselves. And sin not being like we're polluted by this, awful cooties that, there's nothing can wash off. It's not Lady Macbeth, but just the sense that we all err and we all we're all we aim for the mark and we miss, and so like you're like, you know, it's okay. And sometimes we have an extreme example here. So we said last time, here it goes. The main idea, why does the story come here? Judith, it was a young man, and he came up with a very clever young man solution to save his brother, to sell him into slavery. And for his age, maybe, that seemed really wise. But what sin did he do that he didn't even realize, perhaps, or he didn't understand that he was doing? So, like, he intended well, but that arrow that missed the mark, it struck somebody. Who did it strike? We'll keep Saul and Diana out of it because they stayed till the end last time. Who did that arrow strike? Really badly.
The father.
The father. Jacob. Jacob's in his prime. Jacob, Israel. Jacob, you know, he just wrestled the angel. He's in his prime. His sons are young. His tribe is growing. He's in the land of Israel. He's completely struck down. He becomes completely ineffectual after this. Now, you could say there was a little bit of karma for him because of favoritism. Lynn showed me a study this week. 80% of parents favor one child over another, right? That's glad you're in the other 20%, but don't look for any karma. So, okay, no. No, but like, it's true. I mean, that's, but exactly right. Jacob is invisible here, but he's been completely struck with grief. Grief over a child or grief over these things, unfortunately, in Jewish law, I mean, the way of the world is you're supposed to do your absolute best not to let grief take away your nefesh, take away your animating force, steal your soul. But grief can do it, which is what it can do, is it can make you basically, you're the walking dead, right? Your nefesh, how brightly your candle burns in this world, it goes to a little flicker, and that doesn't buy you any more time later. So if you want to, you know, be in mourning for the rest of your life, you get to do that and you'll die. Like, it doesn't mean, well, I'm saving up to burn brighter later. It doesn't work that way. So so Jacob goes dim and he basically loses control and he doesn't have more children. He's bereft in grief that he can't get over. And when you think about it, it was Judah's fault. So what happens to Judah here? He just keeps losing sons. The reason he won't have Tamar sleep with Shelah is every one of his sons who sleeps with Tamar dies. So he's like, that's easy. I will just promise Tamar to my son Shelah, but I'll never actually let them get married. So he keeps her in limbo where she has no status in society and she's desperate. He's reduced her basically to a kind of homeless person with a promise that that someday she'll get married. But he doesn't because he's worried that his son's going to die. He's going to lose another son. So it's horrible, but he experiences the loss of sons that it debilitates him. And then there in that moment, he said, I did wrong, and I'm going to make up for it, and he comes back to strength. So it is, that seems to be partly what's going on. He experiences something that it never occurred to him because he was a young man. Any reactions or comments before we go on to Potiphar? Yeah.
So what about the karma of his two sons that lost their lives?
Yeah, I mean, not everything is karma, right? Yeah, I mean,
you're doing this to Judah, but what about those two?
Okay, so that's a good question. So did God kill the sons? Like, in other words, is God... That's a good question. Like, so I don't know the answer to this question, so I open it up. Using the example I'm doing, if someone takes my parking spot at Target last night, right? Sure. I'm still carrying my parking spot. So I hate that Target. Like, I can never get a spot anyway. So, actually, this is true in, like, Rancho Bernardo in general. But don't drive me. I mean, like, you can't get any parking around here. I went to Santa Cruz for a couple of days. I had to for a reason. I could park anywhere I wanted. Like, what is up with San Diego? So, like, these parking lots, you have these big, like, shopping centers, and you have, like, 50 spots. I mean, the question is this. I mean, it's a question I ask myself all the time, and maybe it's an embarrassing question to ask. Like, I'm maybe going to regret it the second it comes out of my mouth. When someone cuts me off and takes my spot, did God make them do it? Or are we talking about... Chris, are you like, hell yeah, Rabbi? Did that to
you? Yeah, you know I think that.
Actually, it was me, you know.
it was actually me. I'm the one out there taking the parties.
Or was it the angel of evil? My mezuzah isn't kosher enough. And the angel of evil got me. Like, is it that the world is this like superstitious bunch of forces that make this happen? Or can I walk the edge where I say, you know, like, this is an opportunity to look about whether I do this and to become a better person without thinking that, like, you know, God made it happen. So, yeah, what's the answer to that? I don't know. I think about it all the time.
You also look at it, and excuse my language, shit happens.
Mm-hmm. That,
you know, it's God set into power, you know, all these powers of the world. We all have the ability to act with freedom within those powers. So people are going to do bad things.
I like it.
What if it's not about you?
Right. They had to get there.
Because they were late for work and they just spilled coffee all over their pants and they have to go grab a new pair from Target. Yeah. I mean, you can make a nice story.
No, that happened to me once. So. No, that literally happened to me. And guess what? It was closed. No, it was closed. Target doesn't open. It was 8:30 in the morning. I had one of the biggest presentations of my life, and I spilled coffee all over my suit. And I went to Target just to get a new shirt, and they weren't open yet. But I did get a spot because it was empty. So, well, let's get going, Gloria.
It's about you if you're the kind of person that blames everybody else. You know, I mean, for example, okay, Misha did something in school last week, and I mean, I've done it when I was in school. He wrote a note, okay. And I told him, I said, yeah, you know, so-and-so kissed so-and-so, and he got in trouble. But I said, the fact that you did that really didn't bother me, the fact that you lied. I said, so we told you not to do that. I said, so what, was good at Misha over here? I mean, evil Misha, that wasn't bad. Bad Misha over here just said, don't do it. And good Misha over here was like taking a nap. So I'm instilling in him that it's your choice. I mean, you could listen to bad Misha or listen to good Misha and say, well, Mommy told you don't like that note. You know, so if I'm having a good day, I seem to get all the great parking spots. You know, I'm like, oh, look at this. You know, sometimes I choose not to take it because I want to walk that day. I'm like, oh, look at that. And I always say, Baruch Hashem, Baruch Hashem. But if I don't get a good spot, I don't go, you must. I don't, you know.
Why do I have this video on my phone?
Right. It's my choice to put it on somebody else.
Do you ever worry, I'm going to ask you straight up, and this is true for everyone, I know we're going around, it's like, when you say Baruch Hashem, right, thank God, right, are you running the risk of the football player in 5 hours who's going to spike the ball and say Jesus did it or God did it, right, that, well, if you drop the ball, then God did it. Like, I mean, you run the risk that when you say, thank God this happened, that when someone does spill the coffee on you or you don't get the spot, you're like, you know what? It's all about me because God didn't want me to do it. You know, like, how do you walk the line?
It's my intent of how when I say, bro, I don't think that God gave me that spot. I think that, you know, I'm just thanking him for, you know, me being here and having a good day, and it's, you know, it's the energy that I'm putting around me, and it's like, I'm like, yeah, thank you, it's a good day, thank you, Lord. You know, it's not just like, you know, God's on my side today, wench, so get a, you know,
so
get a good spot.
So Deborah's saying, so the spot is a reminder, and we might put it this way, which is, I try to be careful with how much Baruch Hashem, because it can become very much about a person, you know what I mean? But I try to think of it as the word Baruch, basically, blessing just simply means you get more than you deserve. You get more than you need. It is as simple as, you know, you got what you know, your wish came true kind of thing. Like, and we don't, so I think of it as Baruch Hashem, I got more than I deserve. In other words, rather than I deserve that spot because I was here first. I'm just like, that person's pulling out right when I'm pulling in. I get more than I deserve because then, it's not that when I don't get the spot, You know, you and I have to have a talk, you know, like, because clearly you've spent your day worrying about my parking spot, and you were in for me. Because it goes back to the whole, the mezuzah thing, and the this thing, and the angel of death thing, and you can't have a baby shower because then you're inviting the angel of death to pick on you, and then it's your fault if something bad happens. And it's like, as if you know, it's all this concrete, natural, like, you've turned the supernatural into just, I mean, I don't like that category. It's all supernatural. And so, and the supernatural is all about you and your interaction, rather than something that's walking the line, which is, I've gotten more than I deserve. And so when I don't get more than I deserve, you know, I should live with my lot. Like, I should take my lot with grace, with peace. But when I get with more than I deserve, I should say a little word that says, this is more than I deserve. I mean, I look at my kids. You know, I'm overflowing with it all the time. It's more than I deserve. I mean, really more than I deserve. Like, a million billion times more than I deserve. And I just feel it all the time. Like, I mean, I just can't believe it. You know, like, and so it's just that, how do you live with, to me, that's one way you walk the line. But Maria, I'm sorry.
I think it's just too, for me, it's the gratefulness, you know, mm-hmm. And it does create, you know, I live with an opposite. My husband is a grump. People ask me all the time if he's mad, and he just walks around with that grumpy face. And he's never mad at anything, but he's definitely, I'll look at something and I'll say, oh, there's a crack on the cement. Oh, yeah, but it's still part of cement. It kind of looks nice. The earth is now going to go down, and now the house is going to, you know, he's that guy. We have to check the foundation. Because now we're going to, you know, the money it's going to cost us. Oh, my God. Already. And so for me, I'm just like, so I'm on the opposite end. And so for me, I feel like, you know, so we've been doing this, you know, just reading some of these grateful books, and we've been journaling to be grateful, just writing down things we're grateful for. And it gets so tedious and it gets difficult. And especially for somebody like him, because... You know, he's grateful for his wife, his children, his job, and, you know, his food on the table.
Right. You know, if anyone's interested, you can go to my YouTube website. But the Yom Kippur evening sermon this year was on gratitude, because gratitude is something you practice.
Yeah.
It's not a feeling. And that's why many of the prayers are gratitude practices.
But if you start attracting that, if you really are really living that parking spot gratitude, because I get that way too. It just becomes a little bit part of the stuff that you're attracting. And, you know, you don't get your way all the time, but I walk around telling people, I am the luckiest girl. Like, I have so much luck. I'm always lucky. And then all of a sudden, I always get luckier and luckier. And so I feel like just because being grateful kind of presents that situation, and then you just... Mm-hmm. You see it, and so then you accept it, and then maybe I am blinded to all the negativity and all the stuff that's going on, and I do look at life through maybe some pink and purple colored glitter glasses.
Okay. That's okay.
And that's as long as that's me. And so, but for me, that makes my life easier to live this way. Because if I lived it the other way, like sometimes I think, how do you do this every day, you know? And, you know, we even each other out, my husband and I, but I do feel sometimes it's just, wow, you know, it's crazy how he never does that. And I'm always doing that.
That's why he married you, too.
Well, it's interesting the way Judah turns here. I just should point out, he doesn't say, God has killed my children, and now God was sending me a message.
He doesn't say,
so
blessed.
Now I should, what does he say? And someone else said it. He just says, I should do the right thing.
Yeah.
It's like, talk about the little Mishas, you know? You know, really, I mean, he's just like...
Yeah.
All he says is, do the right thing. So one way to view it is this, which is when, and I know it's a simple thing to say, and it has its weaknesses, but if thank God means, if Baruch Hashem, blessed be God means, I get more than I, this is, thank, you know, it's a gratitude for I get more than I deserve. When bad things happen, you know, it's, first of all, you have to realize this is part of life. There was no promise that every day was going to be a blessing. And then to kind of say, if you want to view the Judah story as the rabbis do, as Midah Keneged Midah, that by paying that price, he's able to be a better person. And it's not because he's now like, well, I don't want God to strike me down. Like, God, this is not all about me and God. It's about me. I mean, but not in God's mind. It's about, it is an opportunity for me to grow. And it's an opportunity for me to try to reach out and be different. I mean, you know, the hardest, the people who have lost a child, it's unthinkable. And I try to get them into, there's an amazing support group for it called Compassionate Friends. And it's only people who have gone through it. And, you know, and I've had a hard time getting people to go. And one of the things I try to remind them is, you got to go because maybe you can help someone else. Right? Like, what if someone else is in that group? You're like, I'm gonna work through my grief alone. Right? And I'm like watching that nefesh be like just this like little flicker. But it's like maybe you get the opportunity that this is. And look, is it what God intended to take your child so you can help someone else? No. No, like again, that's like the whole world is just your story and your drama, and you're the main character in the Bible. No, but it is about walking that line between, okay, when I don't get what I deserve, what am I going to do with that? And here, do I choose to do the right thing and grow and not say, you know, I'm the entire focus of God's time. Nurit.
Well, no, I was just thinking when you were talking, it's what I have found that what you put your attention to grows. But
right.
If you put your attention on positive, and you know, then you will see more positive. You probably will be more lucky because you're smiling, and people are going to be attracted to you because you're a happy, upbeat person. And so there are going to be opportunities that are going to come your way because of that. So, I mean, that's kind of how I think about it sometimes,
and
you know.
And the glitter.
Yeah, the fairy dust, whatever. You know. So I think there's that, and that's something that. But I do think that, you know, that. Also, because you have mentioned that before, Rabbi, that, you know, God is not necessarily just focusing on one of us. It's like you're looking at the big picture. And so it's not like this one-on-one relationship, but it's just opportunities. When good things happen and when bad things happen,
right.
It's always a choice to reevaluate in how you respond. Now, I think it's easier to be, and I like saying thank you, God, too, but I don't necessarily think of it, like, oh, I have more than this. I just say, thank you. I want to acknowledge rather than just always clutching about what's not right. I want to acknowledge this is a good thing, so thank you. That's kind of thing. Right. I don't know what I'll
have. And I'm going to go around on that, but Deborah, how did you put it again? Do you remember how you put it? You put it really well to start us off. Because I said, is it really about you? Like, do you experience it as, well, God did this to me? Anyway, if you remember again, there's a way you phrased it.
Because it was a reminder?
Yeah, maybe that. You were like, it's not about me. It's not all about you. I mean, it is this idea. I mean, I think the fundamental story of religion is history is God's story. And so the world is God's story. And you're a character in it.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, how can I be that character? So if Judah is like, how can I be this character? I could kill her. I could save my honor, you know, publicly. Could marry Shelach to someone else, blah, 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 blah. And instead, you know, like he stepped forward in a way that takes his place in that story without making it all about him.
Mm-hmm.
And through this, you know, and through claiming the child, he makes possible the kingship and the messiahhood. Mm-hmm. If he had not claimed that child, there wouldn't be any, mm-hmm. you know. And
there's a lizard in here.
So that's good luck.
There are
Alex.
So, you know, thinking about it in a couple of ways, we don't know why. I mean, it doesn't really specifically say why Judah lost his two sons, but maybe those actions gave him the wisdom that he lacked when he was a younger man and sold his brother into slavery. And that's what you were trying to get at, is that these experiences that he's done since, the reason we have this interlude is his experiences since doing this have taught him the value of life and the value of his offspring. Because she's pregnant with my offspring. Yeah, I could cover this up, but then I would lose my offspring.
Yeah. I didn't think of that. It's staring us right in the face. You're exactly right. He now has
two. He thought maybe one more.
Right.
Maybe, but now it ends up being two.
And he didn't know that, right? He doesn't know they're twins yet.
He doesn't know they're
twins
yet.
He just knows that she's a few months pregnant.
But maybe it's that...
Wow, that's very...
Maybe they're replacing the two that he lost. For whatever reasons that they lost their lives, it just happened that, yes, they lost their lives. And in them losing their lives, Judah gains a little bit more wisdom and empathy.
It's so beautiful. I mean, what do we do at a Brit Milah, like at a Bris? right? So at a bris, you have the whole special pillow thing going on, and the whole special pillow, you have the whole special seat, the special chair. And the whole idea is it's the special chair for Elijah, like at the Seder. And why? And what rabbis like me say, but usually baby's crying, so no one listens, it's fine, is that this child could be the Messiah. We have this idea that every child represents hope. And so you're inviting Elijah in because Elijah is going to announce the coming of the Messiah. And it's interesting that in a way, Alex is kind of pointing us to the fact that that hope is here. And that hope is right over there, too.
Yep,
right there. Talking about you. And so, it's interesting. By doing what he did, it is an act of hope. And he does actually produce the origins of the Messianic line.
You don't want to do for the betterment.
Saul, you want your turn.
Yeah, I was going to say is everything that happens, the things that we remember, whether it's the good things or the bad things, is how we're interpreting the world that's happening around us.
Right.
Your parking lot scene is a perfect one because you may want to choose to say, remember, oh my God, someone took my spot. But I would bet that it's, I mean, because I can think of a couple of times as just about pulling into a movie and it's raining, someone pulls up, I'm one spot away from the theater. But you don't remember that, you know. So, and I play that schizophrenic life all the time. Sometimes I'm in the spirit of looking at the things that happen to me, how do I interpret them down the road? That in a way that is positive to me versus negative to me. I've had a lot of bad things happen in my life, and I say, and you can say, oh, it's good that those bad things have happened because I wouldn't be where I am now had not those bad things happened.
Right.
And I'm thrilled where I am now. So it's accumulation of everything and how you want to remember it. One of the instructions I hate the most, and when I hear it on the radio all the time or TV, let's say you have a tornado go through Mississippi someplace, wherever, and one, you know, people will be spared, and they'll say, oh, by the grace of God, I was spared. No, you were not. Things just happened. I hate that expression because what they've now done is they've damned everyone around them.
Right. I mean, that's. I mean, it really goes back to me. If all we did in Torah study today is talk about this idea of, thank God, Baruch Hashem.
Yeah.
It's an incredibly important one because it is the road to perdition. As soon as you say, you know, God let me catch the winning touchdown, of the, you know, God made it happen, not me, you're immediately about, I'm the center of the universe. God's focused on me.
Right.
And then when I get post-concussion syndrome and I shoot myself in the head in my 40s because I can't deal with it, that was God to punish, you know, or something, you know, like, and it's like, no, that was National Football League and they're interested in making money, not interested in player safety and the way they chew up and throw out their athletes. They have enough money to not only do research but to provide much better health care and support for these families, but, you know, they don't. And So it is the road to perdition to start thinking that, yes, God saved me in the Katrina. And then, like, so God decided, your neighbor, I can't stand them. That dog barked all the time. You know? You know, and it's like, so how do you say, like, it's a way of experiencing God's world. In God's world, I got saved that day. I had a good day. I had a blessing day. What do I do with that? How do I take the gratitude for that? Where does that take me into evolving God's story? You know, and so for me, it's like, how does having two great kids, do I just be like, yeah, I got two better kids than you got? You know what I mean? Like, God likes me. You know, God chose me, you know, and versus, you know, how do I take both blessing and adversity and transform them in a way where God's story goes in the direction that God's asked us to take God's story.
I hope this is pertinent. I hear a lot of babysitters that are going to be scientists in college, and always my interview is very in detail, and I always say, do you mind working in a Jewish household? You know, it's the first thing, because I don't want nobody coming up in my house taking care of my kid and hate the fact that I'm Jewish.
I'm with you.
Yeah, so the thing is, it's so funny, I get this question a lot from these young kids, is that, do you believe in God? Do I believe in God? And I said, I know what you're going to say, because I know most scientists don't believe in God. It's very like, I can't touch him. You know, I always say...
That's not true by statistics, but a lot of people think that's the perception.
A lot of people think that.
That's the perception.
And I always tell people, and I come to find in my older age that this is how I believe. If there is no God when I die, I know I have lived a great life because I chose this reality.
Right.
as he was my leader.
Right.
You know? So whether he's here or not, and at the end they go like, guess what? Ain't nobody up there or around there. It's like, hey, you know, I will be remembered as being a great person.
Right.
And my kids will be good people. So.
That's right.
That's,
No, in the Talmud, when they're talking about the afterlife, or they have stories that relate to what is the afterlife, because, like, the idea is that we don't have a picture of the afterlife.
Right.
For those who sell you a picture of the afterlife, they're lapsing into the magical thinking, the charlatanism,
right.
It's all about you, you know, look, if there are 70 virgins waiting for me, whatever they say. But in the Talmud, what they basically say is, they leave it open so that what immortality means is not defined. Like, it can mean different things. And one of the things it can mean is what you said. What if there isn't anything after this per se? And they say, then the imprint you had on this world and the way that you are remembered is your immortality. We did that with the Elisha story. The most famous story about this that most people completely misread is the story of the one guy who doesn't get into heaven. So the one guy who doesn't get into heaven in the Talmud is Elisha ben Abuya, one of the great rabbis, friend of Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Meir, who is one of their close friends, and he decides to leave Judaism and embrace Greek and Hellenistic religion. So he doesn't get to go to heaven because he's a heretic. And what they do is they tell, so what they record in the Talmud is all these stories of his teachings. And then they say, but don't be like him because he became a heretic, didn't go to heaven. But the whole thing is they just completely subverted the entire story. Because what did they do? They said, you should know the story of the rabbi, the only person who doesn't get into heaven. And then they tell his whole story about his life and who he was and all of his teachings and all of that. He's recorded in the immortal document of the Talmud, everything he ever taught. Is everything I'm going to get taught going to get in the Talmud? No. What is this? You know, like, he got immortality. Like, they immortalized him by sharing his teachings with the greatest of the greats. And it was all, in a way, a joke, because what they're saying is, like, maybe that's what immortality might only be, how we're remembered, and whether your teachings live on.
Right.
And his teachings will live on forever, because they did that, as friends. His friends recorded the teachings. And so, in a way, they made him immortal. And because of the way he was remembered, he was loved by them. And he was a good friend. One of his most famous stories is that he's teaching, and they record this whole teaching he teaches. And then he says to his friend, oh, wait a second, it's Shabbat. And if we go any further, you're going to break Shabbat. One of the rules of Shabbat is you can't go beyond the town boundary. You can't travel between towns on Shabbat. So they're at the border of the town, and they're walking and talking. And the heretic says to his friend, you got to stop, because I'm a heretic. I can break Shabbat. I don't care. But you are my friend, and you care, and you shouldn't break Shabbat. And so, like, one of the things that it records is, like, that he was such a great friend. Like, he cared. So anyway, I just want to point out that, right, but there are other definitions of immortality that are really, really profound. Some are heaven-like, but one of my favorites is that they basically say that when you participate in God's story, which is history, you know, his story, God's story, then you become part of what is immortal. So let's say in your life, you are part of the immortal battle of good against evil. Then you participated in something immortal. That is an immortal battle. That is an immortal drama. And that part of what immortality means, rather than I just did my thing and I like the Denver Broncos. And none of that's going to mean anything in 30 years, you know what I mean, or 50 years or 100 years. But the idea that I was part of the drama of God's plan of lifting up the lowly or living with honor or passing on honor to my children, the effects of that are immortal. So that it's about what story do you want to be a part of during your life, your own limited story or a larger story. And that's really what we're trying to teach our children, and it's an almost impossible task. In other words, it's very, very hard to say that you get to by participating in what Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah, and Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Moses participated in, you get immortality. Because Judaism is immortal. The plan for this world by God is immortal. When you get to participate in it, you're participating, you gain immortality. But most people just think, oh no, that's a bunch of old stuff that doesn't mean anything. You know, and it's like, it's the only thing that means anything. because the temporal things of this world, you know, whether I like HBO and whether I like the Broncos and whether I like, you know, Chinese food and whatever it is, the things that we busy ourselves with, you know, they don't last. I mean, you know, even the thing making money and buying things, all of that will pass to other people within 100 years. So it doesn't last. So let's, do we have 10? Gloria, is that your hand?
It's my hand.
You get the last word.
Because I think this is not a, I'm not sure this is the religious the comment, but I was waiting for this was before I got religion, and I was waiting for a guy to pull out of a parking spot. And he finally pulled out, and another guy zoomed in and took the spot. And the guy from Costco came over and said to him, no, 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 she was waiting for the spot.
That has never happened to me.
And it was such an experience. I didn't think it came from God. I wasn't, you know, it was just, oh, my God. And he made him get out. He had to get out of that parking spot. And he told me to go in.
It was an angel.
It must have been.
But that is, if the world... Right. I mean, and I don't have to tell you, we talked about before, but like all of us in this room, we've all had that experience where someone else needs the spot and I'm not in a rush. You know, if it's that important to you, take it. You can do that nastily. Right? You can. Wait, no, you never do that, Gloria. I know. You were the one that,
I would never do that either.
No, you would never do that. No, it's true. But if the world was more like that, where people were both more like giving, flexible, let things go more, and also stood up for others. I mean, I don't do it nearly enough, but I'm grateful for the times I have stood up for others. You know, and it's like, you know, and not standing idly by. The world would change. I mean, that's what God's calling us to do. It doesn't take a lot for the world to change. And this is what we talk about on High Holy Days, which is what it is that the basic mechanical dynamic of High Holy Days, and I preached on it, it's probably on YouTube, is this. If you make a change in a positive direction, you get grace. You get, and what grace is God will help you with momentum. So that, you know, Obama's trying to put money behind cancer research, right? It's like, will $1 billion cure cancer? Absolutely not.
No, they've been trying to find it for
exactly. And they've spent more than that.
I don't even give them any money anymore because they just send me presents. That's all they do.
I love
they
the free stamps.
Anything, I don't want it.
Right. No, I know. I can't stand the gimmicks. But the bottom line is this, which is that when you turn toward putting money and energy into an area, at first you'll get resistance. But after a while, God, if it's in the right direction, God will give you the wind at your sails. God will give you a boost. So it's not that, like when people say something like, oh, Israel is putting, you know, millions of dollars into algae research as an alternative fuel. And people are like, $10 or $20 million or $50 million of algae research is not going to create a new fuel for this planet. Yeah, duh, we know that. But by starting down the road of even doing algae research, and then Misha becomes, what do you call it, not an intern. You know, he does, gets an internship or an apprenticeship or whatever, and he's like at a lab doing that. And then, you know, he gets interested in that, majors in that. Things build to the point where the focus of the planet is on renewable energies. And by the way, everyone made fun of Israel's algae research, and yet Bill Gates made an announcement at the last, what's that conference called, the big global summit.
Yeah.
He made an announcement that he's forming a multi-billion dollar colloquium, and one of his top priorities is going to be algae research, which is basically pioneered by Israel. So you don't, in other words, $1 billion is not going to cure cancer. We never said it would.
Right.
The idea is, can we start to focus on that, you know, rather than on fracturing or something? Can we start to put our money in a place where the energies of us are going in God's direction? And then God will help you. And the same thing is also true, as I point out, dieting and exercise. You know, it sucks at first, but you will get grace if you hang in there. The grace will be that suddenly you start to like kale, I pointed out. Or you find, you know, you hated all the smoothies anyone ever made for you,
right?
But then you find the smoothie you like, and you're like, you guys are all missing out. I got the best smoothie, right? You know, and like, and it,
and the biscuits.
And the best kids. And well, that's because I don't use kale. I use spinach. Kale, me.
They're all good.
Spinach is good enough. Diana, you know.
So
wait, sorry. Quick question.
So what is the
or comment
or the philosopher say about like momentum? Like even with Miss Moore, I was saying with like, well, when I see things in a positive light, it builds on itself. Or if you a big thing that I always focus on is like that which you focus on expands.
Right.
So that's like a huge thing for me.
Yeah.
It's like what I'm focusing on is what's going to expand.
Right.
So what does it say like in the Talmud or the philosophers about, like obviously if you try and take care of yourself and you eat healthy, that's like the natural world. But then like you were saying, like you also need the mystical and don't try and guess or don't try and put yourself, like don't put your own thoughts into what that is, because like you're saying, you're now trying to do God's work. Or, like, what does God say, or what does it say about like the momentum shift? Like when, like with the wind in the sails, like if things are going in a positive direction, you're going to get the parking spot or you're going to always be lucky. But there's a physics behind momentum, because I see it in the markets. I mean, I know how to play momentum. And I know how to play pullbacks and whatever. Like, and when things are going down, they're going to continue to go down. And I know that because I see it, and it's basically proven. So how do they say that in kind of a mystical kind of a way? Like, how does momentum work?
Well, I mean, three quickies. One is that when we stand there on High Holy Days and we say, and it comes from the Torah, Adonai, Adonai, El Rachum V'chanu. So it lists the attributes of God, and the attributes start with God is the God of compassion and of grace. So Rachum and Chanun, and then it goes on with other of other aspects. God is also Chesed. God has love. They represent forces in the world, and one of them is grace. And that is a force, like, and I argue that that is like a momentum force, which is that if you make tshuva, if you turn toward God, God will be, if you walk with God, God will be with you, and not every step of the way, not like, oh, now God's with me right now. And I'd be careful about saying, well, if I have a positive, I would be careful about saying I can make empty parking spots happen.
Right,
I'm serious. This is where like the book The Secret and stuff I think goes too far, which is I'm going to make reality adapt because I'm going to think it. I think it just is yet another system, charlatan system of superstitionism, where it's like
we all know healthy people that still die.
Right. There's still people
like
that
Jim Fixon is, if I exercise every second, I'll but he had a heart attack.
Right, so that it's not, it's right, no, it's a downer. So you're not making it happen. It's not a physics of making, it's not like a metaphysics of making it happen in your life, like, because you have the system down. You get your mezuzah on the just right thing, and then your kids don't get sick. Or you get your, there are a lot of people who do this, you get your hamsa, and then you're set to go. Or you get your red string, or you say your blood. How could I get sick? I went to shul. I say my prayer. So anytime you think it's your story, and the physics is sort of an ecosystem that just has its border around you, so that what you do has a direct impact on you, it's not always true. You're walking the edge of saying, well, one thing like health that like, how can I put it? And this may not be the best thing, but. How the people say, I figured it all out, it's all about gluten. I figured it all out, it's all about sugar. Mm-hmm. Or I figured it all out, it's all about animal products. And I don't judge the people in the sense that, to me, what they're doing is they're trying to find a diet
for their genetics,
for their genetics and for themselves. And I don't want to dissuade anyone from tshuva, from repentance. So anyone who's like, or they say, oh, Rabbi, forget about walking, forget about swimming, forget about biking, I do Taibo or something. I'm like, instead of saying, hey, it's all good, I don't want to dissuade them.
It's like
them saying, I've had people say, Rabbi, I don't come to synagogue, I got daven at home because that's the real way to daven. And rather than say, you didn't find the real way to pray. Like there are many ways to pray. I just say, good for you. Tell me how it goes. Tell me about this, the real way to daven, as opposed to what the rest of us are doing. You know, like, but good. I don't want to dissuade you. But I don't want to. I don't want to stand in your way. I don't want to be the angel that stands in your way, preventing you from your path. But that said, I don't know if it's really about the fact that they discovered the right system, but that they found a hook to get them going in the right direction, to get the right momentum, and I want to support that. At the same time, is if they don't get the results they want, if they made it about their system, then they're going to be confused, right? I mean, if you think that, you know, your Chabad rabbi coming over and changing out your mezuzahs and putting chamsas and saying certain prayers are going to, you know, heal your child, then your system's too small.
Snake oil.
It is a form of snake oil because it's too small a system. The real thing, and I wonder about this with the markets and stuff like that, is we want to make the system bigger. In other words, like, yes, I want health for me, and I want health for my family, but what I really want is health. I'm trying to put the energy into the bigger system, God's system, the whole society system. Because the view of the prophets is on the society, not on you. So when the prophet tells you, when Isaiah says, you know, Becky, you got to be a better person. And you got to put money in the tzedakah box. And you got to pray more. And you got to learn. What they're saying is, because we need an effect on the society. Not because I want you to, you know, reap the rewards in your own life. So, like, in the sense that any movement that's moving, so my attitude is I don't scoff at any of it, not because it's all movements in the direction of health. You know what I mean? It's all movements in the direction of focus on the mind-body connection. It's all but it could be that, and so I've skirted your question, so I'm back to you, which is positive thinking and the power of positive thinking. The results of the power of positive thinking may not be experienced in your own life. But the question is that what the Kabbalists are saying with these forces of chesed, the forces of chayin, of chanun, the forces of grace, the forces of compassion, you are channeling the forces into a larger pool. It's a larger ecosystem. And so you may not get the results directly in your life of like the power of positive thinking producing positive things for you, although you might, but you are definitely putting that energy into other people may reap the benefits instead of you. In other words, you may go gluten-free, and it may not solve your problem, but it may solve someone else's problem. Or it may be that the gluten diet leads to something else that solves someone else's problem. And you want to take ownership of the fact that you are interlinked with everyone else. So although it may not solve your problem, although it may, it may have a way of leading everyone in a more positive direction or having an effect that's hidden from you. So that power of positive thinking is the power. It just doesn't necessarily always produce a result for you, although it may. You're the closest one to it. And then the other question you said, or the other thing I'd say about what the rabbis say is really the Kabbalah answer, which is that what your goal is, and forgive me, I mean, I know we're late, but your goal is that if you could, you can't necessarily, you want to be, if you could see the world as God sees it, so if you could put on God glasses, you would stop seeing tables and chairs and molecules, and you would start seeing these invisible forces at work as well, because they're also real. But none of us get to be God, none of us get the God glasses, because that's what I'm saying. I don't want to believe the Chabad rabbi has it, or the motivational speaker has it, or the person, but none of them don't have it either. None of them don't have any connection to God. They all have things that they can teach me, right? But anyone who says, I've got the system, and I see it all, then to me that's just another snake oil, which is that they're usually trying to get me to buy something, and I don't believe it. But that doesn't mean that the goal of a lot of this is the ability to start being able to start being receptive and intuitive about these energies around us and flowing into society. Because, and therefore, you get feelings about the forces and the momentums. And God willing, you develop an intuition that is picking up on the invisible, which is things like momentum and things like those forces. And we've talked about it before because in a way, it's the central way about what Judaism is saying about how to live. which is you have to know, you don't have to know. The goal is to try to intuit the right actions in the right moment. And none of that is can be rule-based. I can't say that every time you see a homeless person, you put, you know, the rule is, every time you see a homeless person who begs for money, give him a dollar. That's basically the rule in Maimonides.
My son got himself a conductor's belt, and every time somebody walked by him, I don't want to hear your story. He handed out quarters.
I love those belts. Ka-ching, ka-ching.
Yeah.
But let me say it. Which is, you also have to know when, don't go near that guy. Don't go near that beggar. In other words, we have a rule. Give tzedakah to a beggar. What if your gut is saying, I don't think I should be going near that beggar.
Yeah.
But the rabbi told me there's a rule.
But isn't that the difference between cult leaders? Like some people that are love to follow, you ask yourself, how could, I can't even remember the name of some of these people that were cult leaders, that everybody died.
Right, like, Jim Jones.
Thank you. My mind is getting old.
Or David Koresh.
It's like these people feel like they have to have these rules, hidebound rules, and nothing can be extend outside of that rule system.
And not only that, but all of those were leaders who were like, I have the God glasses.
Yeah.
I know exactly what we need to do right now. You need to give your 12-year-old daughter to me to marry for my 400th wife this week. You know, and it is, but so, you right, we can't give over that role to others. But the main thing I'm just saying is like, the weird thing is we have a rule-based religion. We do. And there's a good reason for the rules.
Mm-hmm.
But in any situation, there's more than one rule operating. And so you have to have the wisdom to know which one to implement. Do I give the, do I break the Sabbath right now because this person needs my help, or do I not, right? And, or do I give the tzedakah to this beggar, or do I stay away because I have a creepy feeling about them? So how do we know, I don't know, I can't cook on Shabbat, but my child is hungry and everything we have doesn't seem to feed them. And I'm not sure what to do. So what the Kabbalists are basically saying is that, look, all the rules are really, really, really important because they're guides. But there are multiple rules operating in any one situation, and you have to have the wisdom to know which one to apply. There are two approaches to that. One is you use your brain, which is you use mental wisdom. This is what?
Common sense.
Or and the goal of as you're trying to become a wise person in your life. So Aristotle is the main proponent of this, and Maimonides modeled his stuff on Aristotle, which is a highly developed version of the brain. So that what you do is you say, what would the wise person in Chinese philosophy, the wise sage, what would the wise sage say in this situation? So rather than saying, am I going to cook macaroni and cheese for my kid on Shabbat and break the rule, and instead of saying, well, what do I want to do? What should I do? I say, if I had the King Solomon here, what would King Solomon do? Or who's the wisest person I ever met? Maybe it's my dad. What would my father do? Because Aristotle refers to his father a lot. He says, I often say, what would my father do? Right? What would Rabbi Akiva do? What would Moses do? And for Christians, what does Jesus do? Like, you're trying to think, what would the wise person do? You're trying to tap into the part of the brain that, what would a wise judge do? If I was Judge Judy, the wisest Judge Judy in the world, and they're like, look, you ruined the carpet, but I really need my deposit back. And it's up here, right? You're trying to figure out, well, yeah, the deposit's supposed to go to paying for the carpet, but this person really cleaned the carpet, was dirty. You know, how do I sort it all out and make the right decision? And the Kabbalists, though, add in another piece, which is they're like, it's not just intellectual. It is intuitive. And intuition connects something. It's not even your heart. It's not just, it is your heart, but it's, I mean, I just went to, you know, we taught the kids to fill in today. And I taught them that basically that, I mean, forgive me, but we have a Harry Potter wand in Judaism, and it's called tefillin. And it's like, it creates this three-way thing where, like, God channels through your head, to your muscle, into your heart, and back. And when you, and we wear this, like, wand when we pray, it's like a channeling device. And the reason I'm mentioning is that, what are you trying to do? In a way, you're trying to connect this intuitive part of yourself where the answer presents itself because you're feeling the invisible streams, momentums, forces. You get like people talk about the market, riding the market. You are trying to get a sixth sense. You're trying
like
to
gut, like a gut
feeling. And but this part of us, which I like to call the intuition, the Kabbalists might say is your neshama, is your soul. It takes a lot of honing of that, and you can still be wrong. And it's not about getting the system right. It's not about like I'm a Donna and I'm studying with a Kabbalah teacher in LA or New York and something. You're like, oh, instead of taking the laws of Judaism, forget that. Kabbalah says that's not important. Let me give you a new set of laws. There's the red string law, and there's the mikvah law, and there's this other law. They're just replacing a system with a system. But what Kabbalah was about was keeping the system, but teaching you to develop the sixth sense so that you understand what to do in each moment. And it does involve your brain. Like the Kabbalists are like, you got to know all the laws. But it's not just an intellectual wisdom exercise. It's a sixth sense exercise. And they're like, because that way, so for example, and I use this example all the time, when do you punish a child and when do you forgive them? And this example is central to the Kabbalah. So the answer is, you can gather all the information. Misha, okay, you lied, and that's the part that bothered me, and that's a really good way to go with it, by the way. But like, you're trying to be like the Judge Judy. You're trying to be like, tell me more. What was going on here? I need more information. What was the context? Did your friend tell you? Were you protecting a friend?
Right.
Like, before you just say, you broke the rule and you're punished, I'm trying to understand why you broke the rule. So that would be more Maimonides. I'm trying to be a wise judge. Give me all of the relevant facts. And now I'll try to figure out how to handle it. And the mystic, the Kabbalist, who also has all those rules, is also saying, is there a way that I could, just by having Misha walk into the room...
We're going to lose 10. I'm sorry about that. We're going to lose 10 if you want to do a prayer.
Okay. But I may have already lost you because you got kids to pick up. So do you want to do the Kaddish with us?
Yeah.
Okay, stand.
Sorry.
Which is just this. You put on your... if you could have an intuition to be like, I feel that what Misha needs here is X, Y, or Z. You feel it. You sense it because you're in touch with those momentums and ripples and eddies of what's going on around you. Not because you know exactly what they look like, but because you develop a feel for how to be a parent and what he needs. What is the right thing in this situation? Yikadal v'yikadash shemei rabah v'yama divrakirute v'yamlif malchute v'chayechon v'yomechon v'chayeh d'chol beit Yisrael v'agala v'zman kariv imru amen. Yehe shemei rabah mevarach l'olam ulamei amaya Yiparach, v'yishtabach, v'yipa'ar, v'yitramam, v'yinaseh, v'yitadar, v'yitaleh, v'yitalal, sh'meidu kudashah, v'yichu. Al rabbanam, v'al tamideihun, v'al kol tamidei tamideihun, v'al kol man da'askim v'oraita, divi atradim, v'divi cholata v'yotar. Yehe lechon ulchon shlama rabba, chinah v'chista v'rachamim, v'chayin arichin v'zona revicha, u'forkanam v'kodav avanhov yishmaya v'imru. Amen. Yehe shlama rabba min shamaya, וחיים טובים עלינו ועל כל ישראל, ואמרו אמן, עושה שלום במרומיו, וברחמיו יעשה שלום עלינו ועל כל ישראל, ואמרו אמן. May those who occupy themselves with words of Torah channel the forces of compassion and grace into this world to make it a better place. Amen. Which is exactly what it says. Thanks for staying late. I'm sorry I went so long. We're off next week, President's Week.
I just got to say, so what?
Sure.
So if I'm understanding you correctly about the original Kabbalists, they were all super nerds. Because they were getting that they had to know the rules, but they also got that they had to
they were super
pay
nerds.
Attention to other stuff. So they really had to be on top of things. They had to be like, they had to be super nerds. They had to be smart about more than one thing.
That is exactly right.
Okay.